It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown T minus 5, 4, 3. Two, one.
Welcome to the Skippy and Fanny Show, episode 105.
Moving to a farm to escape the stupid decisions of science fiction writers.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And today's guest is Jane Rogers. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So let's get right off to the big first question we always ask everybody, which is, what sort of drew you into writing? You've written quite a few novels at this point. So what kind of drew you into writing, and then why did you kind of go with a science fictional premise for The Testament of Jesse Lamb?
Well, to start at the beginning, what drew me into writing, I've always written. You know, I wrote as a child, I wrote stories and made things up, and so I always wanted to write. I always knew I wanted to write, but the thing is, I didn't think that you could necessarily make a living at it. So, you know, I did other jobs. But I sold my first novel when I was 29, and since then I've written fairly steadily. Jesse Lamb's my eighth novel, and I've done other bits and pieces in between, but I've pretty much made the main part of my career as a freelance writer. I don't just write novels, I write scripts as well.
Oh, really? That's fantastic.
Yeah, I've written some television, and I write quite a lot for radio, so yeah. And then,
yay, radio.
Hooray for radio. And then to go to the second part of your question, what drew me to science fiction, it's interesting. I didn't deliberately set out to write science fiction. I mean, I didn't think of it in that way. What I thought was, I need to write this novel, and certain types of things need to happen in it. How can I make this work? I know I'll set it in the future. And that made it science fiction, I guess. a lot of the important things in a novel are the same, whether you're writing historical fiction or contemporary literary fiction or science fiction. You know, the big things that really matter, having characters that are interesting, having a plot that works, those things, no matter what time frame you're using, they're still totally central. So I don't see science fiction as being, you know, off over there, a special different thing. It's part of a whole range of types of genre that interest me.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because Sean and I here have arguments all the time about, you know, what makes science fiction. And in his mind, it really is just that it's set in the future. To me, it's not just that it's set in the future, at least for The Testament of Jesse Lamb, but also that MDS obviously plays a really huge part in the novel, it being sort of the thing that causes everything in the rest of the book. And there's a literary term for that I always forget. But I suppose I should explain to people, MDS is maternal
death syndrome.
Death syndrome.
Yeah.
Very, very, very strong term there. Yeah. And I'm going to jump into what, in a sense, that I took away from the story more than the things the science fiction necessarily predicated. So Jesse Lamb is your main character. She's a 16-year-old girl, a normal sort of life, and suddenly MDS hits, and she has to learn how to deal with it, figure out what to do with herself because of it. But what I found really interesting about her is that she's essentially portrayed as a very rational being, not necessarily completely in control of her emotions, but definitely in control of her decisions. But I felt that this rationality is only convincing because she's being contrasted to characters like her Aunt Mandy and the girl Rosa Davis, who make similar decisions in a sense, but for totally irrational reasons. Why did you feel that it was necessary to create this contrast between Jesse and particularly those two characters for the novel?
Well, that's quite an interesting question, because, of course, what happens in the book is that the novel's told from Jesse's point of view. And when any of us tell a story featuring ourselves, we are capable of making ourselves sound extremely sensible and extremely rational and doing the right thing. You've accepted Jessie's line that she is entirely rational and sensible, and that these other people are not sensible. It seems to me quite possible that Rosa Davis could be sensible as well in her own way, and that there may be many things about her that Jessie hasn't understood. The first person narrator is not always reliable, and the first person narrator has has a very privileged position, because they can put themselves in a good light.
Yeah,
in other words, Jen, you got fooled.
No. Okay, and here's the thing: is I felt like by the end of it, especially because I am a mother, I felt like I had to accept her as a rational being. I had to accept her lie, if it is a lie, because if I didn't, this book would have even been more heartbreaking than it already was.
I'm not saying it's a lie, but I think, you know, I was very conscious. I mean, obviously, I am a child and a parent. I mean, everybody's a child, but and also many of us are also parents. And so I was very interested in seeing Jessie's story from two sides, from the point of view of Jessie, the child who is seeking independence and who is seeking what seems to her to be a perfectly rational act, and seeing it from the point of view of her parents, who see it as a completely insane act. Right. And I really wanted the reader to to be forced to decide what they thought about that at the end. I mean, I didn't want it to be an obvious answer.
It definitely wasn't. I'll give you that. I mean, there were times that I could shift myself into Jesse's sort of point of view of the 16-year-olds. You know, I remember being in that position. It's been a while, but not too long. And you know, seeking that independence and making those decisions regardless of what your parents might feel, and the, you know, sort of elements of looking at other people and going, my God, they're completely crazy, but I'm totally in the right. Mm. And then at other times, shifting myself into the parents' point of view and going, oh my God, this is really, really tough. They're losing their child in more than one way, you know, sort of metaphorically, because she's getting her independence, and literally. And so there were times that I was the one, and there were times that I was the other. And it was the other part that was the parent, you know, sort of point of view that became... And I was crying like a baby at the end. So.
Oh, good.
I texted Sean and was like, I hate this book. It's making me cry like a baby. And but I did find it interesting that seemed to be sort of the central struggle.
Yes, it was
in the book.
And I mean that was the central idea behind writing the book. I mean, I initially, what I was interested in writing about, I was interested in exploring that moment when, a teenager makes a bid for independence and makes a bid to define herself against the characters and lives of her parents. We all do it. You know, everybody does it, not necessarily in such a dramatic way as Jessie, but that moment comes in all our lives where we feel the need to say, I'm not like you, and I'm going to do this, and you can't stop me. And that's part of growing up. And it's also the way in which each successive generation kind of pushes the previous generation out of the limelight and, you know, and steps into it. And that was the thing I was really interested in exploring in this novel. And in fact, in an earlier drafts, there is an equal amount actually written from the father's point of view, giving his side of the story in minute detail. So I did actually have the two sides quite displayed quite even-handedly in an earlier draft. And then I decided to cut the father.
Why did you cut the father? I'm really curious, because that's fascinating.
I cut him because, firstly, I felt the book was a bit long and flabby. And secondly, because I felt that, in a sense, the father's reaction was predictable. You know, you could imagine that he would be horrified, that he would want to protect his daughter and so on. And I thought, well, if I just allow his side of it to emerge through what his daughter describes him as doing, where it's kind of more dramatic because it's more intense. We're just focused on her. But, you know, through her, we are seeing only too well the situation that the parents are in. And we can imagine and add on to that things that we think that they're feeling, that we see that she's not really understanding. You know, I can do it all through her limited point of view, and it'll be more focused and it'll be more concentrated.
Yeah, and it also, I think, changes, too, that in some sort of, maybe not quite sick, but I want to say a sick way, you start to root for Jesse towards the end, even though you know that you're rooting for a very troublesome, morally questionable sort of end.
Right.
But yet you get to this point and you're like, I want her to succeed, but I also feel kind of awful inside that I want her to succeed so much.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's one of the great things as a writer of being able to use the first person voice, because I think once you are, as a reader, reading a first person voice, you get carried into that head, you get carried into that personality, and you do develop an extraordinary kind of empathy with them, even if you disagree with them. You know, even if they're evil, you if you're allowed into their head by the writer, if you're drawn in, you do develop a degree of sympathy with that perspective.
Absolutely. So I want to switch gears temporarily to one of the big parts of this novel, and I think a lot of people who've read the novel have noticed that as your world is kind of falling apart rather slowly. I mean, obviously MDS, for those that don't know, you've learned pretty quick. MDS, basically, if you get pregnant, you die. And it's a awful, terrible, like brain-eating kind of death. So pregnancy is basically out in this world. And so what happens is you have all these kinds of groups kind of show up, and a lot of them are made up of teenagers. You have like the Animal Liberation Front, you have Yofi, you have Flame, you have the Noahs, all of these kinds of groups springing up, and some of them are rather extreme. And I was really curious, were you concerned that you might represent too many extremes, or was there a particular goal for you that you had in mind for bringing these kind of very extreme groups together?
How did it come about? I suppose it was just, one of the things that interested me once I started thinking very hard about this was the sense that people in Jesse's generation, the younger generation, would blame the older generation for what had happened, and would blame them both specifically by saying, you know, you have developed dodgy science, which has led to this biological blip, which has created this disaster, but also, you know, you've trashed the planet, you've used up all our resources, you know, you are leaving us a mess. And so once you start to think that the young are quite rightly very angry with the old, then you start to think about the forms and the channels that that anger will take, and the specific aspects of the civilization of the older generation that the young people might wish to start attacking. And so then I just kind of followed my nose in various directions. So, you know, as you said, I got the religious ones, the Noahs, and then I thought of the kind of the feminist group, Flame, and then the group who are absolutely against any form of scientific experimentation, especially on animals, so the Animal Liberation Front people. And so each group kind of took one of the aspects that the young could justifiably be angry about and ran with it. And one of the things I was interested in showing was that Jesse actually had a whole range of ways of responding to what had happened that she could have chosen to be part of, and indeed she was part of Yoffi, this young person's protest group, for a while, but that she eventually felt that all these forms of protest were actually completely futile.
Yeah, but in a sense for me, you know, I'm skipping around, Sean. I hope you don't mind.
Though
that's totally true in the course of the story that you, it was very interesting to see how her decisions were rationalized against the opinions of the protest groups, or along with the actions and opinions of the protest groups, and you know, kind of how they interacted. In a sense, though, like by the end of it, I started feeling, and maybe because I took more of the parent role on, and because I'm older and I've got a 10 and 11 year old, so I'm like right at that cusp of puberty and everything, that in some ways it felt like her final decision was in vain. And like we were talking about earlier, you know, you have that, though I wasn't really judging her decision necessarily, I was judging the outcome of the decision and the repercussions of MTS and what would happen after this story took place. And it seemed in some ways that by drawing her out of the protest groups, and watching kind of the debacle that occurs around the protest groups, you have the Wettenhall protest that just results in chaos and kind of is a disaster. That in some ways I felt like nothing would really change even if she went through with this final act. Did you feel, was that an important fact to you, like what happened after? Or
no,
was it something that you just kind of wanted to leave up to sort of the interpretation of the reader?
Well, I did want to leave it up to the interpretation of the reader, but you know, if you sort of weigh up the decision that she took and the assumptions of the people around her, I mean the assumption, you know, I mean, let's pretend, let's say all this really happened. it seems to me that the most likely response of the majority of the population, who considered themselves to be sensible, would be, on the whole, humanity is pretty clever. We've got ourselves into some tight corners. We get out of them. Research will fix this. There will be a scientific solution, which is basically what her parents are saying.
Right.
You know, scientists, you know, we've got all these different possibilities already. We've done lots of research. We understand what's going on. We're going to crack this. And, you know, during the course of the novel, they already develop an immunization against
right.
the disease. It's just the problem is that everybody's already got it.
Right.
But you know, so that's one possibility that could happen. But the other thing is that, you know, what Jessie is doing in giving up her life to produce a child is ensuring that at the very minimum there will be a number of human beings in the next generation who can carry the whole thing forward. Certainly, you know, when I was conceiving the novel and thinking about what Jessie thought, I thought and believed that. I thought that that was a perfectly reasonable thing to imagine. So I, and also, you know, you say the Wettenhall protest did end in a complete mess. That's true. And the protest groups end up squabbling amongst themselves and being slightly ridiculous, maybe. But on the other hand, each protest group also is making a range of perfectly valid points.
Yeah.
You know, none of them is completely silly. Possibly the Noahs.
No, right. I was like, well, maybe. Yeah, I mean that was what was kind of interesting to me about Flame, which seemed completely valid. Obviously, Alf completely valid. Like you said, Noah's less.
Well, Alf is not just completely valid; it's real.
It's
right.
Real.
Well, that
exactly.
too.
It's real.
The Yoffi, the youth organization. I mean, it was interesting to kind of go through, you know, how much of this is teenaged angst finally getting their shot in the limelight, you know,
yes.
like
yes.
it's how much of it is teenage Shanks just acting out and going, oh, we're totally validated. Yay. You know,
yeah.
That was an interesting sort of facet to see of teenage angst, because teenage angst is often incredibly valid. I mean, it changes generations. The 60s movement, civil rights movement, you see these moments of teenage angst coming out and literally changing the world.
Exactly. And that, I think that's really interesting. You know, the point is that somebody in their teens can, have an idea or a belief and be completely passionate about it and absolutely know that it is right or wrong, because they see the world in a very black and white way. The answers are clear cut. As people get older, they start to prevaricate. They start to have all sorts of, reservations about this, that and the other. And they find it much less easy to act. You know, revolutions on the whole are led by the young. Young people are the people who, actually make things happen.
Yeah.
So true.
That is a really good point, because in some ways this novel's almost a young adult novel. It's not marketed as a young adult novel, but in many senses it has all of the kinds of, I say typical kind of ironically, features of young adult novels. I mean, in some sense, this is Jesse Lamb's kind of coming of age story, in coming to independence. We have, general experiences of a teen life of, resisting parental authority. There's issues of sex in here. There's relationships between people, both platonic and romantic, and on these kinds of things all steaming in this pot with this larger issue. And I do think that's really interesting, and to think about that perspective in that sense, that this is a teenage girl who probably, as you said, is completely unreliable and may be right about a lot of things, but that her perspective is probably going to see a very different picture than maybe those of us in this podcast at this moment will see because of our age.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't set out, to write a young adult novel, but I did set out to show the perspective of a teenager. And in that sense, it is a young adult novel, because it's, it's about being inside a teenage head.
Right. It makes me want to throw it at both my daughters and my husband and any other parent who might want to read it, because I think it really... to me, it kind of, as a parent, it kind of brought home that, oh my God, there was an interesting facet of the hopelessness of the parents, that there's nothing they can do to change it, her decision. But, and that's why I said kind of metaphorically, that's exactly what happens to parents. They eventually have to reach that place where they just let go.
Yes.
And Jesse forces that, inevitably, but... Mm-hmm. Only because her parents are really holding on really tight. And granted, you totally don't blame them for that. I would do the same thing, I'm sure, in their position. But there is that point where a parent has to say, okay, and just kind of release. And there is that point where a child has to say and take that stand.
Yeah.
And like, hence why I said I want to throw it at everybody, young adult and parent.
That's good. So Please do.
I will.
Well, don't throw it at
them. Well, maybe not throwing it at them.
I'm slightly quiet.
Absolutely.
Because I think it really, it helped me understand as an adult to re-understand that position of a young adult. And as a parent to understand the necessity of that break.
It's a very, very tough thing, because, if your child... decides to do something that you completely hate and know in your heart or feel or believe in your heart is the wrong thing. If your child joins a religious cult that you don't like, if you're a pacifist and your child decides to be a soldier, whatever, your child is extremely likely to make life choices which are completely against what you want. And in fact, one of the reasons that they may choose to do them is because they have perceived that they're what you don't want.
Right.
And there comes a point where you can't hold on to that. And that interests me very much. I mean, I've written quite a lot about the relationships between parents and children in other novels as well. I mean, this is the first time I've taken a teenager on the point of independence, but there are other aspects of the parent-child relationship that I've been interested in exploring. And it's funny because I haven't ever thought, I write about parents and children. But if you look back over the eight novels, it's a theme which I find that I have repeatedly explored in different ways, and I guess there's something about it that obsesses me slightly.
Well, clearly it obsesses Jen too. So,
I'm at that cusp with my children. You know,
got like 5 years before they start rebelling.
Not really.
They're 10. They
might start younger. They might start younger than that.
Oh. Yeah, I've got an 11-year-old going through puberty and a 10-year-old. So, yeah, no, it's starting now.
Okay.
Just saying.
One of the questions I did want to ask, because Jen and I are obviously Americans, if you can't tell from our ridiculous accents.
I absolutely can tell from your delightful accents, yes.
I was curious because I've only been to the UK on vacation a few times and obviously have missed all of the moments when the United Kingdom, or particularly England, has its own kind of protest movements. Like, I was not there during the what started as protests and then became riots in London and other parts. And I'm curious, is, in your experience, having lived there, I'm assuming your whole life, is the relationship there with protest movements, are protest movements more visible in England or the United Kingdom than perhaps somewhere as enormous as the United States would see it? I mean, is it sort of like when there's a protest, it's kind of hard to avoid it? I'm trying to like puzzle out how for you that kind of protest consciousness exists.
My guess is that it's not that different, really. I mean, I think historically one moves through different time periods where, where different kinds of protest are more visible. I mean, you know, in the States, certainly if you go back to, you know, the anti-Vietnam demonstrations and all that, you had huge visible protest movements. I mean, in this country, the riots don't really kind of count as a protest movement because they weren't for a coherent reason. You know, there wasn't a coherent organization behind them that was that was asking for specific things. I mean, people have spent a lot of time and wasted a lot of words trying to analyze what caused the riots and you know, finding all sorts of sociological and economical reasons for them, but to consciously protest for a specific cause or against a specific event, you know, there's usually some historical moment that causes that, isn't there? I mean, you know, like the Arab Spring. I mean, there are historical forces that operate and that cause people at a certain time to go, you know, we object to this, and a bunch of us are going to get together and say, you know, ban the bomb or whatever it is that we're going to say.
Yeah.
Does that answer the question? Sorry.
Yeah, no, I think that does. I mean, it was a curious thing for me because when I was talking to people who had read the book, they had seen the various groups, like they were so extreme for them, and perhaps some of my experience. I mean, I've done a little bit of teaching. I've taught about the Animal Liberation Front in classes, so I know some of what what we call extreme groups are up to. And I was really curious if perhaps there was a different, because I feel in my experience, and I was not around during the Vietnam protests. I wasn't there, and neither was Jen.
Mm-hmm.
So she,
not that I know of.
No, but for me, their Occupy is probably the biggest protest that I can remember in my life, and that's the most recent one. But I've been around for what I feel is quite a while.
Yeah, but you see, I mean, okay, a group like the Animal Liberation Front. I mean, what happens with the Animal Liberation Front is that occasionally you get a little a burst of anger and energy focused on a specific event. I mean, for example, the last one that I can remember was that there was a new research lab being built in Oxford, I mean, part of Oxford University, which was going to be apparently experimenting on monkeys and various animals. And there were protests on site, and there was some violence, and I think there may even have been a couple of bombs, small bombs planted in people's cars, and you know, a car's got damaged or something. I mean, so you didn't have mass violence and riots on the street, but you had a sense that there was a specific thing that was happening that a specific group were angry about, and it hit the headlines for a few days, and then, you know, it faded away. So it's not something which is in the news every day, and it's not something which is impinging on huge numbers of people's lives. But it, you know, the Animal Liberation Front continues, and you know, is having meetings, and doubtless has its own. Well, I mean, I know it does, because I a very lively online presence, and continues to be angry about ways in which animals are mistreated. But that doesn't mean that it's going to come to everybody's notice all day long.
That's true. That's true.
Okay, so real quick, because we've kind of focused on the relationship between Jessie and her parents and the independence of a teenager and whatnot. But you did have, and I'm shocked actually that Sean didn't put this as one of his questions, because it is one of our favorite topics. Do portray some of the fallout of MDS and the questions of morality of research on animals, obviously, in terms of the Animal Liberation Front. Flame has issues with scientists who are predominantly male. They eventually might, you know, control our wombs and things like that, and reproduction, and that's their end game. The Sleeping Beauties are a moral sticking point for some people. The fact that essentially to continue the human race, women do have to die. But then you also have the really interesting factor of the Implanon, which is
that's right.
The, you know, implanted birth control device that every girl receives, which I was like, sign me up for that. But at 16, yeah, that would have been epic, I think. But what I found really interesting is, and it's very briefly mentioned, and like I said, I'm surprised Sean hasn't mentioned this, the fact that one of the effects of MDS is the shift in relationships between men and women, and the sudden fearful nature of particularly teenagers. But women who are like, why would I have sex with you and risk getting pregnant and therefore dying, and men therefore being kind of, which also creates some very interesting social problems in terms of the gangs of roving men and higher incidence of rape and things like that.
It also includes instances when men seem to be engaging in like homosexual behavior, not because they necessarily want to, but because it becomes kind of a necessity.
Right.
I think in terms of the gangs, again, I mean, there's the implication that some of the boys in those gangs are, like, either exchanging favors or something of that nature, because I guess gay sex now, suddenly it's safe.
Much safer than straight sex, suddenly, is really kind of the implication. And so being gay is suddenly more accepted, on both sides, both male and female. And I thought that was a really interesting sort of repercussion of this. How did you kind of reach that decision in the social aspect of MDS?
It was just following the idea through, really. I mean, I just tried to think, you know, what would happen? How would it be? How would it be if you knew that having sex for a girl was potentially, you know, could lead to death. You know, what effect might that have? And also, I started to think about the ways in which people have reacted to people who have illnesses, even if those illnesses are latent rather than, you know, evident. And so for a little while, I was thinking particularly about the early days of AIDS, when AIDS became identified, and people, you know, there was a sense that people with AIDS were either discriminated against or vilified simply for being ill.
Still are, to some extent, yeah.
Indeed. And it seemed to me that, therefore, it would be perfectly possible that groups of people, and it would have to be men, obviously, might start to feel that way towards women, because they see women as having potentially being capable of developing this disease and therefore of being diseased. And in fact, I use that phrase in one of the gang members who rapes Jesse's friend talks about women having diseases inside them. So really, I was just trying to take, you know, aspects of life now and push them to an extreme and find out how I imagined people might respond if this kind of virus was out in the world and was affecting people. And I mean, there were various aspects of this novel I did a lot of research for, but you can't research this because it's in the future. So it's just about imagining.
To me, that's what made this the most science fictional, was those little elements of obviously, well, I say science fictional, but that's when it really hits the speculative fiction sort of territory.
Yes.
Is the imagining of that.
Speculative, yeah, because it's the future. And I mean, what, you know, as a writer, what you do and obviously what other science fiction writers do as well. I mean, you try to ground it in science, which is as well researched and as plausible as possible. And I did research, you know, I did research the virus itself. I mean, it is, I am told, scientifically just about possible. And I did a lot of research into methods of bringing babies to term outside the human body and artificial wombs and that kind of stuff. Because, you know, it was important to make the research. I mean, the research and the science has to be as convincing as possible so that you actually believe in the character's dilemma. Mm.
That's a good point, too. And actually, one of the things I was thinking on the scientific question, it's almost like MDS is a really fast-acting super form of, like, syphilis, which does eat into someone's brain. And granted...
Well, they called it mad cow disease. I'm sorry, for the moment, the more scientific name of it has gone out of my head.
Nobody knows the scientific name anyway in the United States. We all call it mad cow disease.
That disease, you know, that disease does destroy your brain in that way.
Right.
I mean, more slowly, not as fast as I've got it happening in the book, but it does destroy your brain in that way.
Yeah, it's a really terrifying future. Just so we're clear.
Yes.
Like, and yeah. I'm a man, so it's not as terrifying for me, but that's still terrifying. Just the idea that something that quick, and it's almost like humanity stops. Because at that point, what else matters except finding a solution to that? And of course, you know, in the book, a lot of the characters almost essentially give up. I mean, you take Aunt Mandy, who...
I was just about to mention her, yeah.
Yeah, who... through part of the novel is kind of going through this like mental breakdown and trying to, I guess, find her place in the world. Mm. And then even finally, like, actually snaps at one point in the book. And she's kind of a sidelined character. She's kind of in the background, and it's more the family talking about how they're trying to help her. But it is sort of all of these kinds of elements going on of all of the ways in which characters are struggling with suddenly the status quo is just flipped. I mean, it's not like a gradual change. It's like overnight.
Yeah.
The world is boof, just like everything's just thrown out of whack. And I think that's really fascinating. And I appreciate the nuances, the ways in which just little details of how characters have reacted is really useful.
Yeah, and particularly with Mandy, who, you know, it's like everybody knows that, you know, 30, 40-year-old woman who wished she could have had children and wanted to have children, but whatever life circumstances, she didn't have then. And then for Mandy, you know, this horrible disease happens, and she never will get to have that sort of realization of having children and being a mother, which was, you know, it's like I personally know people like that. Sean might not.
I do too. And I wanted, I mean, I needed, what I needed to do in constructing the book and thinking about how Jesse's decision would grow in importance for her was to pressurize her by surrounding her by people who were adversely affected by MDS in different ways. Yeah. And I mean, through seeing her aunt, who she loves and who she's had a close relationship with, you know, obsessively trying to get pregnant and even, you know, at the point when she knows it will be a death sentence if she does it, you know, for Jessie, that's a huge pressure, because that tells Jessie, you know, women feel like this. This is, unless we can fix this, other people are going to go through this. So in a sense, you know, the characters that surround her, I mean, each of them has their own story, of course, but each of those stories to some extent helps to sway Jessie in making the decision that she makes. And that's, you know, that's one reason why Mandy is placed as she is, obviously. And obviously also she's kind of a foil to Jessie's mother.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I did kind of wish we got to know more about Mandy, like before the moment, because we do get little glimpses from Jessie about how Aunt Mandy used to be and all the kinds of like the eclectic things she have in her house, and it was kind of that you could kind of feel the sadness from Jessie and kind of seeing her aunt, knowing that her aunt used to be this different person and now has just become almost alien. Well, in a way.
And you mentioned those nuances of the fact that Jessie, you know, in some ways she was partially, and I wouldn't say raised by Mandy, but Mandy was very much a mother figure to Jessie. And so for part of Jessie's understanding of what her aunt is going through, and probably part of what her mom's understanding of what her sister's going through, is that aspect of, why isn't this enough for you? Why wasn't I enough for you? Why do you have to go through this extreme just to have what I thought you already had? And I thought that was a really interesting sort of interplay between her mother and her sister and Jessie herself. So, yeah.
I'm glad it worked like that for you. That's good.
You could tell we love the book, so...
Can you?
Yeah, I think so. Okay, I've got one last question, which, and then we'll go into our quick fives and then our like actual final question. And this question kind of comes out of nowhere because there's no way to transition appropriately except for this very awkward transition.
Okay.
Which is actually that your novel is structured, so it's got what we eventually realize is taking place in Jessie's future, which is in, I think, like Core Your New font. It's obviously looks different than the other section. And then you have your main section, which is in her past. And these two are driving to kind of meet each other towards the end. And I was really curious, why did you want to structure the novel this way? Or what was kind of the attempt in making this in this kind of structure?
Okay, it's an interesting one because, as I've told you, the earlier draft, earlier drafts of the novel, I mean, I revise hugely, but an earlier draft had the father's voice in it as well as Jessie's voice. And the way that I structured that was that I intercut them. So you had a chapter from Jessie followed by a chapter from her dad, followed by a chapter from Jessie. So when I stripped the father out completely, I simply had a linear story told by Jessie from beginning to end. And it felt quite bald that, you know, because I'd lost my double narrative. And I also was quite interested in finding a way of alerting the reader very early on in the novel to the fact that something really serious actually was going to happen. Because it's perfectly possible to get into a story narrated by a teenager who thinks they're the center of the world and that important things are happening, and then they can just burble on and be boring for 200 pages. And I wanted the reader to know that that wasn't going to happen. So by putting the fact that she is kidnapped and being held in a small room with her legs locked together, right up at the front of the novel, the reader will know that something really serious is going on here. But the reader won't exactly know what it is. And so it does allow me to inject suspense right at the beginning, and to maintain that suspense by dipping into, I mean, it's her present. You said it was her future. It's her present. Her present is that she is being held captive by her father. And while she is being held captive, since she has nothing else to do, since she is completely unable to carry on with her life, she is forced to review her story. So it gives a logic for telling the story as well. And I quite like that when I'm working with a first-person narrator, for there to be a reason for them to tell a story, you know, rather than just blarting off and blathering on about themselves. If there's a focus and a reason for it, again, it's likely to make the book tighter and to improve the suspense.
Hmm. Yeah, and you're right. I misspoke. It is her present, not her future. Both are moving towards her future, but not necessarily. Yeah. Okay, that was good. Good. I was really curious about that, and now I have my answer. So, all right. So let's move on to our quick fives. These are kind of our silly questions. They're just really quick ones. So we're gonna take for our fives the premise that the world is ending. So our first question is: would you rather be surrounded by teenagers or college students?
College students.
All right. Second question. Would you rather be barricaded at a farm or in a grocery store?
A farm.
Ah, good choice. Good choice. Third one. What one book would you save from your collection?
Complete Works of Shakespeare.
Ooh, good choice again. Number four. Would you defend yourself with a makeshift spear or a potato gun?
A spear.
And the last one, if you could save one mechanical device, such as like a car or a tractor or something like that, what would you save? And you got to give me a specific model. So if you save a car, you got to give me a model.
Oh, that's really pointless. Could I have some kind of a tool?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Any mechanical device.
Yeah.
Well, I think I'd have an axe.
Ooh.
Is that a mechanical device? I mean, there's no point in having a car because you've got no petrol. There's no point in having something that takes electricity or fuel. You need an axe.
Well, you could always go with a wind turbine.
Sorry?
you could always go with a wind turbine. Or.
Nah,
she's going with axe. I like how the silly questions, you're even thinking like through the implications.
I've been thinking a lot about survival for the simple reason that I've been reading a lot of novels, a lot of dystopias, because I'm writing a piece about them. But also, you know, I told you I did work in radio, and what I've been doing today is recording a dramatization of John Wyndham's The Chrysalids.
I'm so excited about that.
I'm thinking a lot about Wyndham, and I'm thinking about you know, end of the world scenarios and what's useful and what's not useful. So I am quite up on this at the moment. Not because of Jesse Lamb, but because of looking at the chrysalids and at that kind of primitive lifestyle where obviously, you know, after some kind of nuclear holocaust, you are back to very primitive means of farming and of living and you don't have petrol and things like that.
You got to think this, like next time somebody thinks, oh yeah, I'll just get in a truck and drive around, like you'll run out of gas really quick.
Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, it's interesting because we never actually mentioned Lisa, who is your character that decides to live on a farm, but she was my hero.
That's why I asked the question about the farm, because
yes,
exactly.
There is an actual farm.
The farm is the obvious place to be, I think. Yeah,
I think so too.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so you mentioned you were working on a radio production of The Chrysalids. So when will that be coming out for listeners, and what other kinds of things have you got coming up?
Oh, well, it's going to be broadcast on BBC Radio 4 on the 29th of July and 1 week later, which will be August the 4th or something.
Oh.
So it's a program we have here called Classic Serial, where a novel is adapted, and this is going to be two episodes of an hour each, of the full story of The Chrysalids. Yeah.
Fantastic.
And anything else coming up in maybe the next few months?
A collection of short stories in the autumn.
Oh, fantastic.
Not science fiction, not set in the future, but very, very, very ranging around the world. Some set in Africa, some in England, some in Australia.
But it's all good literature.
This might be a science fiction and fantasy show, but we also happen to like good literature. So,
well, that's actually really why I wanted to get you on the show, because I do like, you know, adventurous sci-fi and fantasy and those kinds of things. a lot. I get a lot of pleasure out of reading them. But I also really like the kind of, I hate to use the word, but the literary works. And when the novel came up in my email for review, I was like, I even want to interview her, like, desperately. Like, I want to get you on here. And it should be noted that Testament of Jesse Lamb did get the Clark Award and was longlisted for a Man Booker.
Congratulations, by the way.
So,
thank you very much.
Big deal. So, anywho, so that about does it. So, thank you so much for spending all of this time with us and answering our questions and taking the time out of your busy day.
Yes, thank you.
Right. Well, thank you for asking me, and thank you for liking the book. And yeah, it's been good talking to you.
You too.
Okay. Take care.
Take care.
Bye bye.
Bye. Perfect.
Scene?
Oh yeah, yeah. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Afraid to face death.
I pass in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.